This evening's scripture reading is Daniel chapter 3. Last week, you might recall, we read from Daniel chapter 1 and 2. We looked at the situation a little bit of God's young men, Daniel and his friends, under a very proud and very pagan king. And this evening we are going to look now particularly at Daniel's three friends and the test that they underwent when they were called on to make a very clear and a very distinct choice. Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace, that they should heat the furnace one 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, "Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said unto the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake, and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Were there any parts of this evening's reading that you found a little bit tedious? Could you have done with hearing the list of officials just once rather than several times? Could you have done with hearing the list of instruments just once rather than several times? What's the purpose of listing those things each time over again? I'm not certain. I don't know if it was clear to the people of that day when these words were written. I'm not sure if anyone today really knows for certain, but I suspect something. That those lists are given, and maybe given more than once, to show the weight of what was against Daniel's three friends. Look at that opening list of officials. Who has commanded this image? Nebuchadnezzar, a man who can order around princes, governors, captains, judges, treasurers, counselors, sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces. The power in Nebuchadnezzar's hands was awe-inspiring. Think of the size of this image. 60 cubits. That's 60 cubits. If we understand our biblical measures correctly, that's about 90 feet high. Now that's an image. Covered with what? It's an image of gold. Imagine what that must have made as far as an impression goes on the people of that day. Set up in the plain, there under the near eastern sun, an awesome image. An awesome list of officials. An impressive collection of music. Music is a powerful thing, isn't it? Imagine all those instruments being played throughout the empire in ways that people could hear them. Imagine how easy it must have been to be swept up in the entire thing. This is what people do. This is what the whole world does. Nebuchadnezzar said specifically, this is for people of all places. This is for all nations. This is for all languages. And we have every reason to believe that that's the way it worked out. That everybody was doing it at the time they were supposed to do it. I think it's fair to say that in some ways we're a little more jaded today. I don't think we're as jaded and sophisticated as we sometimes think we are in our society. But I think we're a little, maybe, less easily impressed by sounds, colors, and large images. So imagine what it must have been like in that day to hear the music, to see the gathering of officials, to see the image, to know the power of the king. What did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have to offer in response to that? Nebuchadnezzar's power is overwhelming. It is all an impressive display. And note that really, in the eyes of the whole world, a very reasonable thing was being asked. They're not being asked to abandon the God of Israel. They're not being told they may pray to Him. They're being told only that they have to accept this image as well. When they hear the sounds of the music, bow down to the image. You know, we know from surviving manuscripts that there were Roman authors, pagan Roman authors, who were just astounded and angered by the horrible intolerance of the Jews and later of the Christians. Not because they worshiped this particular god. The Romans didn't care about that. But that they would worship no other. They were intolerant. And yes, I do think that is very similar to what we see today. Go ahead and worship your Jesus. But be tolerant. And when the world calls on you also to worship the world, don't be fanatic. Accept diversity. Worship also what the world tells you to worship. Is that not reasonable? Nebuchadnezzar rules the world. The Roman Empire has brought peace to the whole world. How can you not, at least now and then, bow down and acknowledge that? What do these three young men have? They have so much to lose, don't they? They have risen to high positions. Think how useful they were in protecting their fellow Jews in Babylon. Think how useful it was to them to have the lines of communication open with Nebuchadnezzar on behalf of their people. They had a lot to lose. They seemingly had nothing to gain. But yet, it seems, from what we read in Daniel, that they almost didn't even think about it. It was just a given. Look at their reaction to the king's decree. Verse 12. The king is told about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they're described this way. O king, they have not regarded thee. Or in other translations, they pay no attention, or they have not made any of account of it. And that appears to have been true. They simply ignored the king. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is furious. Verse 13, furious with rage, or filled with rage and fury, as your translation has it. That's the offended arrogance of the wicked. Remember who Nebuchadnezzar was. We looked at that a little bit last Sunday night. A man who owned people, body, as far as he was concerned, soul and everything else. He owned the world. Individuals were his property. And now these young men have no regard for his decree, the offended arrogance of the wicked. But yet, he makes what the world must certainly have regarded as a very reasonable response. He does not say, kill them. He does not say, throw them in the furnace. He calls the three young men and he says, is this true? A number of commentators suggest that this was really a question of a man trying to help these young men out. Is this something you did intentionally? Were you really intending to do this? Did you do this truly with malicious intent or design against me? Some think those questions by the king suggest incredulity. He just couldn't imagine that these three men would do this. And in some ways, his response is very reasonable. In verse 15, it seems that he is patiently offering them a second chance. Now, if you are ready, that at what time you hear the sound of the instruments, well, he's offering them another opportunity. Was that not reasonable? Think for a moment. I know it's easy to pass on quickly, but think for a moment the temptation it must have been to the three young men. We've made our point. We've said something about our monotheism. We didn't just go along with it unthinkingly like everybody else did. We've let Nebuchadnezzar know we don't approve of this, but we're keeping those lines open. No use throwing away all our influence. We're not denying the God of Abraham. We'll just bow down before the image. But they said no, and they did not hesitate. Even though the king asked them, in a sense, a question that might have produced some real thought in the three young men. What God will be able to rescue you from my hand? That must have seemed like a rather reasonable question given the circumstances. Given the experience of the last years that these young men had experienced being carried off captive. That was a very good question. What God will be able to rescue you from my hand? I wonder if they wondered. But note something else. In a very modern way, the king has totally misunderstood the issue. For the three young Hebrews, it's not an issue of what do you stand to gain. For the three young Hebrews, it's the issue of what is the truth? Who is God? It is not Nebuchadnezzar. It is the God of Abraham, the maker of heaven and earth, and nothing changes that, and they will not serve anyone but the maker of heaven and earth. Nebuchadnezzar, I suspect, is like most people today. Religion is something you do because it works for you. Religion is something you do because it appeals to you. The world cannot understand the Christian who says, but mine is true. And the world might respond, well, it's true for you. It works for you. You know, I was a Christian once too. It didn't work for me. What I'm doing now works for me. You know, as far as exercise go, tennis may work for you. It didn't work for me. Aerobics works for me. Gymnastics works for me. So who are you to tell me to switch? But you see, it's not a question of what works for you. It's a question of what is the truth. And that's what these three men were standing on, the truth. The God of the Hebrews, the God of Abraham made heaven and earth, and that is why he is served. And they will not swerve from that. Why doesn't the church change or compromise? Well, the true church doesn't compromise, does it? Because it stands not on what is advantageous, it stands on what is true. Now, note the response of the three young men. Verse 16. King James says, "We are not careful to answer thee in this matter." That may be a little misleading nowadays, given the changes in English. What that probably means in the Hebrew is, and you'll see this reflected in most other translations, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. I think they gave their answer probably great care. But what they are suggesting is, we don't even feel the need to protect ourselves by answering you. Other suggested translations, it does not behoove us to answer you in this. Or it is not necessary for us. You see, they weren't looking for his favor. They weren't looking for justification from Nebuchadnezzar. They weren't looking for affirmation. They had the God who made heaven and earth. And they did not have to defend standing by him. They have a complete determination in their settled minds. This is what they are going to do, and they cannot be swayed. And they will not even seek a way out by reasoning with the king. Why are they so settled in their minds? Verse 17, because they know whom they serve. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. Now note they don't say he is going to deliver us from the burning furnace. They say he is able to, but they do say he will deliver us. And that seems to be really their meaning, their intentional meaning. We don't know if he'll deliver us from the furnace. He's able to. But even if he doesn't deliver us from the furnace, he will deliver us. Nebuchadnezzar will never own them for eternity. They will never belong to Nebuchadnezzar. They will belong to their God. See, when one worships the God who made heaven and earth, the maker of all, what need is there to seek defense in anything else? Now, the New Testament, of course, tells us, be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in you. But that's a different context. That's not seeking the world's protection. That's explaining the world to the world the basis of our hope. But it's not asking for the world's protection. Of that, the Christian has no need. God is answerable to no one. And in the final analysis, his followers are answerable to no one for their worship of him, only to God himself. These young men seem confident that God in some way will rescue them. How so? Especially in light of what follows. We don't know. But remember, these young men are probably taking this stand with a much less clear vision of an afterlife than we have been given in the gospel of Jesus. Who knows what they believed precisely about what would follow death? But yet, that doesn't matter. Their God is God, and they will stand with him. Psalm 66, verse 12, I think may be of some interest here. The psalmist says, you let men ride over our heads. We went through fire and water, but you brought us to a place of abundance. See, he doesn't say you protected us from defeat. It doesn't say you protected us from all fire and water, all discomfort. It says we went through it, but you brought us to a place of abundance. And perhaps that, in a sense, is all these three young men have. We don't know what or how exactly the Lord will do it, but he will deliver, even if we go into the furnace. Isaiah 43, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. Might they pass through the fire? Yes, they might. But in some way, the Lord will deliver. I think this is one of those places in the Old Testament where the spiritual meaning, the ultimate spiritual meaning, is the primary one. You know, we look around at Christians in the world and we don't see them avoiding every earthly trouble, do we? We do see Christians dying in plagues. We do see Christians dying in wars, in fires, in persecution. But yet, we also see those Christians protected from, sheltered from, the spiritual pollution of the world. The wickedness of the world, the death of the soul. The Christian can live in the midst of that and not be touched, can't he? We'll look at that a little more closely in just a few moments. Verse 18. The young men have an absolute commitment to the truth and to the God of Israel. Even if he does not save them from the furnace, he is still their God, and they will not compromise with the false idols of the heathen. Their religion is one, first of all, of principle, of truth, not of self-interest. It's not about practicality. It's not simply about what works. It's about acknowledging the truth no matter what. I was always struck since I was an adult by that line in Esther where Queen Esther is going in to speak to the king on behalf of the Jews. And what does she say? She doesn't say, I know God's going to give me success. She says, I'm going to go in, I'm going to do it, and if I die, I die. How many of us could or would say that? I will stand by the Lord, and if I die, I die. In some way, in a glorious way, the Lord will still preserve us. And now let's look at the results. Verse 19, the loss of the world's favor and high opinion. Nebuchadnezzar's face was changed against them. That must be a very frightening thing. His whole attitude toward them. Think of not only facing his fury, but losing his favor. What that must have seemed like. The form of his visage was changed against them. But they did not hesitate. They still did not turn aside. The king's favor was a valuable thing. But they will not take the king's favor over God's favor. Now comes the severe testing, verse 21. They are bound and thrown into the furnace, firmly tied. They are cast into a fire so hot, it came back and killed those who had thrown them in. It's quite possible here that this fire had been intensified with pitch or with sulfur. So it may have been this horrible burning heat that radiated far out from the fire. There may have been this horrible blackish, ugly smell as they approached the furnace. And that's important to remember too, that the hideousness of the whole thing, the ugliness of the whole thing. And there they are with all their clothes on. Their clothes, one suspect, would normally, given that they were, of course, natural fabric, have burst into flame even before they got into the fire with that amount of heat. And they are led toward the furnace, and they are thrown in. And note the result. Complete triumph. Look at verse 25. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose or unbound walking in the midst of the fire. That's an interesting thing to think of, isn't it? They're thrown into the fire, and what's the first thing that happens to them? They are unbound from the king's fetters. I think that is a beautiful symbol. I suspect it's intentional. They are thrown into the fire, and the bonds that were put on them are no longer there. They are free to walk about. You know, I think in some ways that's a symbol of death. We believe that, don't we, in Jesus Christ. Death sets free the Christian. They are walking around unhurt. The fire that killed others has no power over them. The power of the fire cannot touch them. See, what is horror and torment for the rest of the world is powerless against those who trust in the Lord completely. And we speak here especially of spiritual things. What is a terror, what is a horror to the rest of the world cannot touch the Christian. Psalm 91. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. You will not fear those things. The terror will not be on you. And then a line that I think is very much to be understood spiritually. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. They are untouched and totally unaffected by the fire. Verse 27. Not only are they unhurt, but their hair is not singed, their robes are not scorched, and there is not even the smell of the fire on them. If you would, for just a moment, think of some of the saddest consequences of your sins. Isn't it sometimes that it makes you vulnerable to the horror, the fear, the doubts that the world has? You know, the sinner has much to fear. I don't even mean that now in the sense of final judgment, although, of course, that's the most important. But just in the sense of what would happen to them in the world. Think of those whose lives are affected for 40, 50 or more years because of the sins of their youth. Think of the grief that they're made vulnerable to by the pollution of their younger days. You see, the Christian who walks only in righteousness is not subjected to those things. the vileness, the obscenity, the filth that is all around us, the Lord will protect the Christian even from those things. The world will fear, the world will fall, but the soul of the Christian will be brought through, purified in Jesus. You'll be free from the stains of the evil world. The king looks in and sees a fourth, someone who looks like the Son of God, or perhaps a son of the gods. What did the king mean? I suspect that the king meant it looks like a superhuman being. But what was it truly? An angel? Possibly. Or some think, and I, again, if I had to guess, I don't know if we're called on to guess, but I would tend to lean toward the idea that it is Jesus himself, protecting these three young men in the midst of the fire. In either case, was it not the power and grace of Jesus Christ which accompanied them in the furnace with them, undergoing the trial with them? And now finally, note the world's acknowledgement. Nebuchadnezzar has a long way to go. We'll see next week. We hope the Lord is willing that Nebuchadnezzar still really doesn't understand humility after this affair. But he is beginning to be pressed and to be forced to acknowledge the truth. In verse 26, he calls them servants of the Most High God. And that shows a great step for a Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it? The servants of the Most High God. The God of the Hebrews is not just one of many. He is not what Nebuchadnezzar or the Romans later would think, or what the world today likes to think, that the God of the Jews, the God of the Christians, is one among many. He is the Most High, and someday every knee will bow and acknowledge that. And they will acknowledge his mighty works. Nebuchadnezzar says, no other God can save in this way. It's a start. Nebuchadnezzar is at least being brought face to face with the truth. What that means for his own life, he apparently does not know yet. But he will be shown that as well. Note Nebuchadnezzar's acknowledgement that the three young men are God's servants. And Nebuchadnezzar is forced to confess that they were righteous in refusing to follow the world. We are promised in the New Testament that someday the world will acknowledge before God who were the servants of Jesus Christ. And they will have to acknowledge that God's people were God's people. And then, again, another hint, another foretaste of the book of Revelation, the appointment of God's servants to rule over the world. The saints will someday rule with Jesus. These three young men are appointed to even higher power than they had before. Is that why they held off from worshiping the image? I don't think so. They refused to worship the image because it was false. But their stand for the truth equips them to rule over others. Revelation 2, verse 26, to him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. Will we stand with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, even to the very end? Let's pray.